Good afternoon. The Senate Committee on Human Services will come to order. It's Monday, March 27th. Welcome back, everybody. We have three bills and three work sessions today. We'll start with the work sessions, and then we'll go through the bills in the order in which they're listed, which is new for us. So I'm going to open up a work session on Senate Bill 104.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 104 expands facilities that submit information to the Department of Human Services background check registry. It declares emergency and is effective on passage. There is a fiscal impact statement issued and a no revenue impact statement issued. The bill was heard on February 15th.
And colleagues, I forwarded you an email that came from DHS. We had originally held this bill because there was the thought that we needed an amendment to be able to cover all residential facilities, but the department, in discussion with the Department of Justice, realized that they did not need the amendment. We have Angie Albee here. If anybody has questions about that, and the department's testimony is uploaded into OLIS. Does anyone have questions about that, or are you okay to move the bill without amending it?
Right, there was already a dash one amendment. We're not using it?
We're not. It turned out that it was an unnecessary dash one amendment.
Ooh, it's what we like, unnecessary.
Would you like to make a motion, Senator
sure.
Olson?
Chair Hillstrom moves Senate Bill 104 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Olson moves Senate Bill 104 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Seeing none, so ordered. So it will go to the floor. Many thanks to Frank Miles for great work on this and really making the system a lot more efficient for people that are both trying to deliver services and receive services. Yep, getting to that. Who would like to carry this bill? Senator Knope, would you like to carry this bill?
Sorry, my dance card's full.
Seriously?
I'll do it.
Okay, Senator Timbrough will carry the bill. I'll close the work session on Senate Bill 104. Just wait. Open up a work session on Senate Bill 140.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 140 appropriates monies from the general fund to the Oregon Youth Authority for gang intervention services in Multnomah County. It declares emergency and is effective on passage. There is a fiscal impact issued and no revenue impact statement issued. We first met on this bill on 3/22. And there's a sub-referral to Joint Ways and Means.
And then my understanding, Senator Montes Anderson, is the bill will be amended in Ways and Means with the appropriate dollar amount?
Yes.
Very good. All right, Senator Olson.
Chair Gilstrap, I move Senate Bill 140 to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that the bill be referred to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference.
Senator Olson moves Senate Bill 140 to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that the bill be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Seeing none, so ordered. It's on its way. Good work, Gresham. Closing the work session on Senate Bill 140 and opening up a work session on Senate Bill 834.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 834 requires the Department of Human Services to develop a proposal for the creation of a Human Rights Commission. It requires the department to report findings and the proposal to the Legislative Assembly by September 1st, 2017. It declares emergency and is effective on passage. There is a dash one amendment which modifies the preamble to include family members, guardians, friends, and caregivers, in addition to service providers, as those who sometimes restrict the activities and freedoms of disabled individuals. It also changes DHS's reporting date for the proposal to December 1st, 2017. The dash one has a minimal expenditure impact and no revenue impact.
Great. Senator Olson.
Chair Gilstrap, I move to adopt the dash one amendment stated 3/17/17.
Senator Olson moves to adopt the dash one amendments to Senate Bill 834 dated 3/17/17. Is there any objection? Or is there any discussion?
Is this for the amendment?
This is for the amendment. On the amendment, any objection? Seeing none, so ordered.
Chair Gilstrap, I move Senate Bill 834 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Olson moves Senate Bill 834 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion?
I have a question. Yes. The amendment still kept
it as forming a human rights commission, correct?
The amendment, so the bill doesn't actually form the human rights commission. It has the department come back and talk about how we might form one.
That's what I wanted to make sure that that's what the bill does, because creating a new program probably doesn't have a whole lot of, I'm very concerned about the budget.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome. Any further discussion?
Hate to lose it.
Seeing none, is there any objection? Seeing none, it heads to the floor, and I'm happy to carry this one since Senator Knope will not. I'll close the work session on Senate Bill 884.
Just opened up.
What? Do you want to co-carry?
No.
Okay, I'm going to close the work session on Senate Bill 834 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 821.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 821 directs the Oregon Housing Stability Council to consult with the Community Action Partnership of Oregon in developing a policy for awarding grants to organizations from the emergency housing account, including aligning the account policies with federal homelessness prevention strategies.
Great, and we have Mark Knecht, Ryan Fisher, and Stacy Lake. No Stacy Lake? Okay. We will not have Stacy Lake.
Okay.
Thank you, Chair Gelser, Vice Chairs, members of the committee. My name is Ryan Fisher, and I'm here today on behalf of the Community Action Partnership of Oregon, which is the statewide association of community action agencies. Community action agencies deliver and administer the emergency housing account through their network that covers all 36 counties in the state. I believe I've had a chance to speak with most of you about this bill and what it does. The State Housing Stability Council determines the eligible uses for the emergency housing account. This is one of the most critical tools that we have to prevent and end homelessness in the state. Oftentimes, the EHA funds, as we call them, the emergency housing account funds, are used to draw down federal funds to prevent and end homelessness. And in order to ensure that we can continue to do this, we are adding a line of statute that gives the Housing Stability Council, when they are determining the eligible uses for this account, the ability to align with federal strategies and resources that are available. And then the other piece that this does is it requires that when the Housing Stability Council is determining these eligible uses, that they receive the advice from the Community Action Partnership of Oregon. They're not required to follow that advice, but we wanted to ensure that those that are delivering these funds at the community level and that are also tracking those federal requirements have an opportunity to make sure that their needs are voiced. So that's essentially what the bill does, and I'm happy to answer any questions if you have them.
Thank you.
Yes, my name is Mark Knecht, and I'm on the Salem Housing Advisory Commission Board, and I just came from a meeting, and I'm the Salem Housing Authority Board, and we just purchased the old M Hill building up there on the state hospital grounds. They're going to renovate that old building and make it into 50 affordable affordable housing units, and I'm just curious as to where the funding is going to come from this. Is it going to come out of HUD, or where is that going to come from, sir?
Would you like me to?
Yes, please.
Chair Gelser, members of the committee, these are state funds for the emergency housing account that come out of the state general fund. Now, they would not be used to develop the property that you're talking about.
Yes, I know.
Okay. And these funds are for services, temporary rent assistance, first and last month's rent, a lot of the kind of those difficult to categorize things that can make the difference between somebody staying in their home or not.
Yeah, I do a lot of advocacy work for veterans and people with disabilities, and we're just going to open up the new veterans transition housing up here in April on Center Street, up there in that old nursing home behind the Catholic Community Services. They have the front of the building, and we have the back of the building. We'll be able to house 30 veterans there, too, to a room. Thank you, sir.
Well, thank you. Are there any questions for this panel? No. Are people comfortable moving this bill today? Is that...
I have no problem.
Senator Monis Anderson, are you comfortable? We're just kind of getting to the end.
It's Monday.
All right. Thank you both very much. And it's good to go. There's no need for amendments.
No, we're good. Thank you.
All right. Very good. All right. I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 821 and open up a work session on Senate Bill 821. And I'm going to find the script and pass it to Senator Dimbrough.
Chair Hill, sir, I move Senate Bill 821 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Dimbrough moves Senate Bill 821 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Seeing none, so ordered. Senator Knope, would you like to carry this bill?
Madam Chair, it's a long one, but I'll do my best.
All right, very good. So Senator Knope will carry. Thank you. I will close the work session on Senate Bill 821 and open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 949.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 949 makes non-competition agreements and employment agreements or contracts for home care workers voidable by the home care worker. There is a dash one amendment which makes a covenant to not solicit other employees or transact business with customers of the in the employment agreement between the employer and home care worker voidable by home care worker. There is a no expenditure impact on the dash one and a no revenue impact on the dash one.
Thank you. So I've got Kendall Mason, Gracia Molina, Kate Newhall. And Lena, did you mean to be on this one or no? Okay. So many sheets, it gets very confusing. Yes.
Chair Gelser, Vice Chair Olson, members of the committee. My name is Kendall Mason, and I'm a policy and political strategist for SEIU Local 503. Thank you for having me here today to talk about Senate Bill 949 and the subsequent Dash 1 amendment. While we currently believe that non-compete clauses are illegal in regards to home care workers, it hasn't really stopped home care agencies from demanding that their workers and their clients, who are the consumers of these home care services, to sign these contracts. And while you may say to yourself, well, if they're illegal, then can't a home care worker just ignore them? That's a lot easier said than done. What we've seen in the field is what amounts to threats of legal action when either a home care worker or consumer decide to move their services from one agency to another or to move their services through the state. To paint a picture, imagine you make $10.80 an hour with no benefits to care for an individual in their home. And that person would otherwise probably be a Medicaid client in a nursing home, which costs the state much more money, I should add. After some time, perhaps you or your client finds a better option for receiving services. Let's say the Oregon Home Care Commission, for example, where you can have a starting pay rate of $14.50 an hour and have access to health care benefits. It's at this moment of moving services to the commission that either the worker or the consumer has been slapped with a cease or desist order and signed by a legal entity representing the agency that you work for. The chances of someone who makes $10.80 an hour understanding the nuances of non-compete clauses are slim, and often cease and desist orders are scary enough to prevent either the worker or the consumer from leaving the agency. And the only recourse a person might feel they have in this situation is to get a lawyer, and that's something that's completely out of reach for workers and consumers alike. This puts workers in a trap of a low-wage job, and it also prevents consumers of Medicaid services from actually being able to exercise choice in from whom and from where they receive their services. This bill and the subsequent amendment makes the law crystal clear that home care workers and those working with them are not bound by non-compete clauses, as they restrict choice and keep workers in poverty wages in this sector. It is a widely known secret that many agencies use these non-compete clauses to keep workers and consumers from leaving for a better option, and we'd like to make it really clear that agencies would be in violation of the law for doing so in order to prevent legal intimidation that we've seen in the industry. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Gelser, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Kate Newhall, here today representing Family Forward Oregon. We're happy to be here today in support of Senate Bill 949. We have been working with SEIU to put a focus on caregiving and the caregiving economy. This is critical work. It's work that underpins everything in our society, everything in our economy, and yet it's seriously undervalued, and the contributions of caregivers are underappreciated. We believe this bill is simple and it's straightforward. We also think non-competes traditionally are something that are intended to protect proprietary information, trade secrets. We don't think that's anything of a situation that applies with a home care worker. We think in this situation, non-competes have been used to trap low-income workers in low-wage jobs, and workers should have the freedom and choice to choose. And we believe that 949 is a good clarification and urge your passage. Thank you.
Thank you.
Hi, Chair Gelson, the Vice Chair, and Olson. Thank you for the community for listening to me. I am here to support of 949. My name is Gracia Molina. I have been a caregiver for 6 years. I've been worked for the state for in two companies. 4 years ago, I worked for a company, but they paid too little. I decided to be a caregiver for the state because they paid more, and I told my patient that I was leaving him, and he wanted to live with me because he liked how I took care of him. The company sent to us cease at the disease and treating to sue us of $40,000 if I left and I take him with me. Then they forced me to sign a non-compete that I did not want to sign. They threatened me at sign, and because I signed because I was afraid. I don't know why I have to sign again if I was leaving. This isn't fair, and it shouldn't happen to anyone. This made me sad and my patient even more sick. Thank you. Please support Bill 949.
Thank you very much. Thanks for being willing to come and share your story. Are there questions for this panel?
I do, Madam Chair. Hi. Can you tell me about the amendments? amendments bring in the clients, I think.
Yeah, we wanted to make sure. When the bill language originally came out, it seemed... Chair Gelser, Vice Chair Olson. It seemed like the language that was written that first came out really protected the home care worker, which we felt good about, but we often saw cases where the consumer was bound by similar agreements, and so it conversely also trapped the home care worker if a consumer decided they wanted to leave or vice versa. So we wanted to make sure that we added more language to the bill to clarify that either the consumer or the home care worker, like whoever's signing any kind of agreement with this agency, that it's all voidable by the home care worker.
Senator Pell?
I don't have any questions for this panel, but I do, I would like to hear from LC or the drafter of the bill regarding these employment agreements, because I do think they're right. I think they're null and void generally, but I just want to kind of hear the legal ramifications of doing this, and if we're going to do it for home care workers, I think we ought to just be clear with everybody that they don't apply to any relationship to the level that the court has indicated.
So I think what we'll do, since we don't have counsel here today, we posted this for a possible work session, but we'll carry it over to what do we have? Is Wednesday our deaf and hard of hearing?
Yes.
Day? So we'll carry it over to next Monday, because Wednesday's pretty full, yeah. And we'll arrange to have the... Can you arrange to have the drafter come?
Yes.
To talk about that? Does that work?
That'd be great. Yeah.
Great. Any other questions for this panel? No, and do you, when you're talking about other parties, just not just in human services, just across the board, how we do non-competes.
Yeah, I mean, I want to hear from the drafter.
Yeah.
You know, obviously this is an important group, and, you know, they shouldn't have to fight for their, you know, their constitutional right not to have to sign these and to abide by them, but neither should anybody else. And so my point is, I just want to hear the legal ramifications of what the court actually said, how it applies to this bill, and then do we need to apply it to pretty much every other Oregonian who may be in a similar situation, although not in healthcare?
Sounds good. Thank you. Any further comments from the panel? Is there anybody else that wants to be heard on this bill? All right. Thank you both.
Thank you
very much. And I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 949. We are running like 20 minutes ahead. So I had texted Representative Stark, who's coming on the next bill, who will be here at 1:30. So let's stand at ease until 1:30 to wait for Representative Stark, who's presenting, helping to do the introduction to the next bill. Is that okay? 6 minutes of free time for everybody? All right.
Senate Bill 942, and Representative Stark, if you'd like to come forward, and Senator Gelser, if you'd like to sit back down, and I can do that.
Is this for the thing, Bomber?
Yes.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 942 directs the Department of Human Services to conduct a statewide study on child safety by July 1st, 2018. There is a -1 amendment which removes a requirement that DHS conduct the study on child safety, and it requires certain findings in investigation of child abuse. It also requires child abuse investigations to be conducted in accordance with statute and result in the findings until specified criteria are met. And the -1 has a no revenue impact and a minimal expenditure impact statement from LFO and LRO.
Thank you. Representative Stark, you have unlimited time. Senator Gelser, you will be limited to a short 2 minutes. Representative Stark, please.
Thank you, Vice Chair Olson. With your permission, I would like to defer to the good senator to start.
Oh, well, she gets 2 minutes. Go ahead. Senator Gelser, please.
Thank you, Senator Olson. Vice Chair Olson, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Sarah Gelser. I'm the state senator from Senate District 8. So Senate Bill 942 is, I want to tell you what it's about and what it's not about before we move into this. What Senate Bill 942 is about is creating a strong foundation for child welfare. We all know that our child welfare system has been struggling. And those that are most impacted by the struggles of our child welfare system are first and foremost the children that are children and youth that are waiting for or need help. And secondly, the dedicated and struggling staff that are working in every single one of our districts. So we're going to talk about some pretty difficult things in this presentation. But what I want to be very clear about is this is not about the workers that are trying very hard to do this work. We as a legislature have not adequately funded our child welfare program. Our budget budgets to about 83% of the workload model for child welfare, but because it's so difficult to retain people in these very difficult jobs, we're closer to about 60% of people actually in the field. I talked with someone in my own district. They have 7 vacant CPS positions right now. We are in a crisis of our child welfare workforce. And that is what this bill is about. How do we get back to the very basics of the things that we need to do to build a strong workforce and to build the foundations of a quality system, which is workforce, assessment, and screening, and making the right choices. This bill is also not about differential response. Differential response is going to come up in this conversation, but it's not about stopping differential response. It's not about whether or not differential response is a good idea or a bad idea. Personally, I think differential response is a great idea to serve families, to do things in a very holistic kind of a way when we have built the infrastructure that allows us to do that safely and allows us to do that well. Unfortunately, that's not what we have right now in Oregon, and that's why this proposes to do something that would slightly modify differential response, but it does not end differential response. This is about assessment. So we know that child welfare in Oregon is struggling. We recently learned that Oregon failed every single measure of quality in our recent federal child welfare assessment, every single one. We've recently paid out tens of millions of dollars in tort claims for children who have been injured or children who have died as they have had contact with the Department of Human Services. We not only have a higher rate of abuse of kids in care that we have taken into care than the national average, we don't meet the national benchmark for preventing re-abuse of children, regardless of where they are, if they're in their family home or if they are in foster care. We have too many child fatalities that are related to abuse and neglect, and our certs tell us that the same problems over and over and over again, and we're going to get to that in a minute. And we have, and I mentioned this before, we have a workforce that is absolutely demoralized, and they are inexperienced because of the high turnover, and they have inadequate access to the training and support that they need and they deserve. When I go out into districts and talk to workers, I hear time and again that CPS workers are crying in their offices every day because this work is so traumatizing and so difficult, and the stakes are so high, and these workers, many of them very young, have to live with the consequences of that work. We also know that screening and assessment, which is the front door to the child welfare, child safety system, is really key. Time and again, if you go back through the certs and read all the certs that are posted online, and I'm the geeky person that's read them all bunches of time, I could probably recite them to you, but time and again, the certs following fatalities point to inappropriate screening decisions, and they point to lack of adequate and comprehensive assessment as a systemic problem that needs to be addressed and that contributed to the fatalities. Screeners, in a report that DHS commissioned by the University of Illinois, reported that they only feel confident that they have made the right decision half the time. Can you imagine doing that work and only having the confidence half the time that you're making the right decision when the stakes are so high? Again, that's not about the workers, that's about the support that we are offering to them. And then we're going to get to this in a little bit, following a cert, the GJ cert, where we once again found a problem with a child in alternative response that had many assessments that deemed her safe when she was not safe, the department decided to go and do a check-in, a quality assessment of kids across the state in the alternative response assessment track that had been deemed safe to see if they were safe. They worked with the Office of Business Intelligence and asked how many cases would we need to pull to get a 90 to 95% confidence interval. That was 101 cases. They pulled 101 cases. Of that, of 76 cases in which the workers determined that kids were safe, the re-review by child safety experts that work for our own Department of Human Services found that 47 of those kids were certainly not safe. And you all got that report over the weekend, and we'll go through some of those details later. These were not modestly unsafe. These were pretty stunning problems. We also know that when you are trying to do new things, new initiatives can really detract from the core responsibilities. This is from an email to Representative Stark's office last summer from Jason Walling, who was the Deputy Director of Child Welfare. He says, they have experienced an increased workload associated with the implementation of differential response, coupled with some unforeseen staff turnover. He goes on to talk about needing to prioritize the mandatory workload, and that as a result, there's a reduced staffing level in the adoption and foster care home study area. We know that we have too many kids in foster care, that we don't have enough placements. Trying to add on new things when there aren't staff to do it is having impacts not just on child safety, but on adoption and foster care as well. Jason Walling also said last summer in one of those emails that DR has increased the workload simply by way of increasing the amount of collaboration that is required in engaging a family. Unfortunately, we do not have additional staff resources to shift to DR counties as they implement and sustain the new practice. So here we have the Deputy of Child Welfare letting Representative Stark know we cannot do the work because we don't have enough people, and this new initiative is taking more time than our staff have, and we don't have the resources to back them up. The University of Illinois found that in their study as well from caseworkers and screeners. Both caseworkers and screeners said their workloads increased after the DR implementation, that they were spending more time, and the screeners, which is the most important first step when you're coming in, especially in DR, there's a lot that hinges on that screener's decision. They say that their staffing levels are not adequate. They are not adequate to do the work that is needed, and this is from the University of Illinois. We also have Lori Byerly from LFO, again, explaining to Representative Stark's office some of this issue, again, saying that DR is taking resources away from adoption home studies and foster family support. And we've heard at length in this committee about the issues that we have when we are not supporting foster families. And Lori also reports that when she does the field work, she's hearing from people that are planning to leave the agency. Again, that goes to this work is so hard, we're losing folks. This is our own legislative fiscal officer who saw this quote this morning. One of the things that we heard was that kids are as safe in DR counties as in non-DR counties. But what does that mean if children are not safe anywhere? This is a child that was not safe, was reported in the media, who is no longer with us in part because of a lack of access to screening and assessment. He didn't get to grow up. We have a lack of comprehensive assessment, which is a systemic problem, as pointed out by the CERTs. We have a high rate of abusive care. We hear reports from CRBs, from foster families, that we have an increased level of trauma of kids that are coming into the system. And again, our CERTs keep telling us that inappropriate screening decisions are a systemic problem. And we also have qualitative and quantitative data that point to severe problems, and we're getting ready to go through that. On the quantitative side, we know that DHS is not meeting key quantitative metrics. We are only meeting the face-to-face visits 67.6% of the time, according to Director Psyche's presentation to Ways and Means just a couple of weeks ago. In that same presentation on the key metrics, only 65% of all child abuse calls assigned for assessment have that first contact within policy guidelines. That means someone has called the hotline, the screener has said that this child is at risk. Does somebody go out when they are supposed to make that initial contact with the child? This is a very, very key metric. After that, in terms of completing the assessment, we are only completing the assessments a third of the time on time, which means that these kids and these families are just waiting. Only three, according to the University of Illinois, despite all of our discussion about differential response, only 3 to 10% of the cases that go into differential response are resulting in any services, depending on the district. And in 2015, that's a typo, out of 2,638 families who had an open assessment on the alternative track, only 174 accepted services. 174. This is out of the University of Illinois study. And on average, assessments are taking at least twice as long to close as permitted by state policy on the DR track. And again, that's from the University of Illinois study that's posted on the DHS website. We also know through our children, our child safety and family, the CSFR, I'm bad at acronyms, that we are not meeting our metrics. The national performance indicator for recurrence of maltreatment is 9.1%. We want to be lower than that. We're higher at 10.9%. Maltreatment in foster care, the national performance indicator is 8.5. We want to be lower. We're at 14.34%. That's enormous. We also, looking at the timelines of the initial investigations, this is again from the CSFR. I just wanted to pull these out from multiple different places that are checking this data. We see that for a 24-hour response, when the screener says, this kid is in so much danger, someone needs to see them within 24 hours, that initial contact is happening only 62% of the time. And the five-day response, which is the majority of the AR cases, that's happening only 15% of the time that somebody is going out within 5 days to put eyes on a child that a screener has determined after somebody has made the trouble to call is in danger. The CSFR, this is from the language, that the case review from the feds revealed challenges similar to those identified in the statewide assessment, that there are practice concerns with making face-to-face contact with alleged victims of abuse and neglect during investigations, and with conducting comprehensive assessments of risk and safety, both initially and at critical case junctures, such as when case circumstances change and prior to case closure. These practice concerns affect the state's ability to engage in appropriate safety planning, especially for children remaining in their family home. This is why these assessments and the ability to determine accurately whether a child is safe is so important, whether it is alternative track or traditional track. I would argue this is a problem in all of our assessments, not just differential response. And then we also know that differential response is contributing to the delayed assessment, according to the CSFR. It talks about, again, this 15.5% of the time, that this is the majority of the differential response
pieces, and that the overall measurement of timeliness for 2015 is 50%, and this is greater in the DR counties. And again, this is according to the federal review, and this is also posted on the DHS website. The staff are also identifying inadequate training. These are some of the critiques that they have pointed out, and this is the University of Illinois study. There needs to be consistency in the message given about the Oregon safety model. That's how assessments are done. We continue to be told different things by different supervisors and consultants. Some felt that the current trainings were too rushed. I feel that CORE had good ideas, but due to having to learn a large amount of information in 4 weeks and not being able to relate this to work, the training I've received has now been lost. And then when they were asked in the CSFR how prepared they felt to do the work based on the training that they got, the majority of our workers that are out in the field doing this work, 44%, feel not at all prepared or slightly prepared when we're sending them out to do this work. Less than 1% feel extremely prepared to do the work. That is not safe to kids, and that is not fair to the people that are working so hard to do this work. And then this also came from the CSFR. Oregon asserts that initial training is available to all staff. However, the training does not meet the readiness need of the new employee. So I mentioned before that this GJ safety assessment happened. They wanted to go back. These were randomly pulled. They didn't go in and look for problem assessments. They just randomly pulled 101 assessments from DR counties. And I have been asked how I access this. I first asked for this report in February in an email to the legislative director when I asked for all of the deliverables from the recent certs. It came up in further conversations. I was in a conversation with a number of folks and Clyde and then I received it last week, I think. And I'd asked for it a few times from a number of people. So the qualitative measures, these are just, so each of these slides is an individual family or child situation where DHS determined that these kids were safe. Case number one, rats were biting the children. There were animal feces, garbage, and other debris, urine-soaked clothing thrown on the floor, medical issues that are not addressed, nobody contacting the physicians. And the case was open for 4 months, which is outside of policy. This one, another case, worker wrote biased statement. As this caseworker arrived at the home, it was immediately apparent that this was not a typical client home. The home was very nice, gated, and situated on a well-maintained property. In this one, this father has a long history of being violent against his children, and these are all quotes directly from the report. No safety threats were considered at all. No analysis was done on the caseworker. The worker seemed to believe that the child was manipulating in order to play sports despite bad grades. The worker did not explore other collaterals, which is talking to people that have information outside the realm of the father's power and control over the mother of the alleged victim, as well as his current partner, so that the DV work was not done. In this one, the person left, somebody different typed it up. The mother allegedly overdosed, but she said that she hadn't and that it was medical issues. There's only one line where there should be more information. The safety threat level is left blank, and there is no basis for the safety decision. This one involves a child that's abandoned with a guy who keeps leaving the kids alone with drug users. The kids have, one of the kids has apparently been sexually abused. Again, the child is deemed safe. Eventually, after they have been deemed safe for a while, the child is eventually removed after being found in the backseat of a car on the lap of a prostitute who also had methamphetamine. In this one, there was a closed at screening the week before, and again, this child was deemed safe. The stepdad was in anger management and mental health, but has to be redirected for being inappropriate and making violent comments about stabbing people and finding dead bodies. The three-year-old was being aggressive with her younger cousin, attempting to kill family pets and trying to stab her father. There was an unable to determine from when that three-year-old ingested a tramadol and ended up in the hospital. The family tried to lock the child in the room to keep her away from the knives. I would suggest locking the knives. But again, this child was found safe despite all of these things and concerns for substance abuse, bruises on the child that were closed at screening instead of being assigned, parents yelling and cussing at the child, not properly dressing her, and the family has repeatedly been found to have moderate to high needs but keeps declining services because the services are voluntary. On this one, the alternative response 5-day was assigned on February 10th. The allegation was that the mother was hallucinating and accessing a firearm. Nobody contacted the child for 2 months. In this one, you've got three adolescent siblings found safe, despite the fact that there's lack of supervision. The father locks them in the basement together for days, only allowing them to leave to use the restroom. The worker narrates that the children are safe because the parents are willing to get the kids into counseling. In this one, the domestic violence situation, again, is not assessed. There is no safety, and we've talked a lot about the challenges in domestic violence and making a change. And in this one, you have a family that is threatening their 7-year-old that they are going to put him back in foster care if he does not change his behavior, and they are found safe. So from both the qualitative and the quantitative information, we can see that the problems are real. If those assessments are ending in the determination that those kids are safe, we have a very severe problem, and we have to change something, and the problems need to be addressed with urgency. And that's what Senate Bill 942 is about. It's about putting the first things first. It's about requiring a strong assessment system by ensuring that at the end of every comprehensive assessment, there is a disposition of founded, unfounded, or unable to determine. That will give us a clear data set so we can compare apples to apples, and it also keeps more eyes on and more accountability for finishing these things on time, which is really important when you have a child that is waiting and at risk. And it says that you, so the Dash 1 amendment says that these dispositions have to be made until these safety milestones are met. We've adequately staffed child welfare to do the work. We have timely initial contact after the report of abuse for 6 months within policy. We have timely completion of a comprehensive assessment. Our re-abuse rate is below the national average, and we have established the statewide centralized child abuse hotline that our certs have been asking us to establish for years and years and years. And I would say the same is true around the comprehensive assessment. For years and years and years, our certs in fatalities have identified that the lack of comprehensive assessment is contributing to child fatality. Senate Bill 942, it does not end differential response. It does not increase the number of kids in foster care. You can have a founded disposition and not have your children removed. Those things are totally different. It does not remove the option of support services from families. We currently provide support services to people in DR counties and non-DR counties. And in DR counties, we provide services to people on the alternative response track and the traditional response track. So it does not change that. It does not undermine the idea of prevention. It does not eliminate relief nurseries. It does not eliminate funding for any of the contracted services, and it does not eliminate culturally responsive practices. We have an obligation to the kids we've lost and the kids we can still help. And I think it's really important to remember that these aren't numbers. These are kids, and these are the faces of some of the kids, and these are all from media reports. But these are some of the kids that we have lost where there is a direct connection to a lack of timely and appropriate screening decisions, multiple closed screenings, and inappropriate assessment. And that price is too big for these kids to pay who are not with us anymore, and we should not continue doing that. And I just want us to remember this every time we talk about the numbers. 19 kids, 27 kids, 30 kids, all of them have faces like these kids. That is what we're talking about. And for the kids that die, if you read through that list in the GJ report that I sent you all this weekend, it is a fluke who lives and who dies. It's a matter of circumstance on an individual day. And I would argue that the tragedy for kids that are forced to live for years in chronic neglect without any help, where someone comes in with the promise of help and nothing happens for them, that is as great of a tragedy, and we have a moral obligation to fix that. We cannot sit here because someone had a good idea once and we want to stick with it. So finally, 942-1 will help us develop the strong foundation that's needed for a quality child welfare system, and it would pave the way for a safe and successful statewide implementation of differential response when the time is right. And when the time is right is when we have an adequate, well-trained, and supported workforce. We have a strong, centralized, and uniform child abuse screening system where our workers are confident they are making the right choices for kids' safety, where we have timely initial contact after the screening assignment, timely and appropriate completion of comprehensive assessment, and we're meeting the national targets for preventing reabuse. Colleagues, this really is very simple. We just need to do dispositions at the end. We have to step up as a legislature to appropriately resource this agency, but we also have to ask the agency to do first things first. We cannot try to do new things when we have not yet figured out how to do the base things. And we can say all day long that kids are just as safe in DR counties as non-DR counties, but I would argue that our kids are not safe anywhere right now, and there are too many kids at risk, and it's urgent that we make a shift. Representative Stark.
Well, good afternoon. Vice Chair Olson and members of the committee. My name is Dwayne Stark, State Representative, House District 4, Southern Oregon, and I'm incredibly depressed at this moment. That's sad stuff. It's tough to take a look at those numbers. And I can't help but wonder, as I think through the system, I've met hundreds of people in the Department of Human Services, and I've never met a single one of them that I thought was a bad person. And I've never met a single one of them that if you drill down and get to know them and ask, you know, why they're doing this, it's all because they want to help children. It's all because they believe in what they're doing. Now, over the years, they might do it for a paycheck or something, but that's not why anybody ever starts. So how in the world could we get to a point where we could have a report like this? And I think that in large part, that's due to us in the legislature. I think that we tend to pile on more and more, and without making sure that those first things are being done the way they're supposed to be done. Reminds me of bad parenting that I do with my children sometimes. And my oldest son, he gets it the worst, where I'll tell him it's chore time, and it'll be about 5 o'clock or something, and he's putting away the dishes, and I'll say, did you feed the dogs? And he says, no. And I'll say, well, go feed the dogs. And then he comes back, and then my wife will come in and get after him because he's not putting away the dishes. You know, where he knows he's supposed to do both things, but at some point, you get to the point where you have too many things piled on you at one time that you can't do any of them to the satisfaction of what you need to do. And I think that we've pushed the department to that level. And I think that differential response is one of those things that has pushed them to that level. When I first heard about DR, before I ever became a legislator, I was incredibly excited about it because I believe in mobilizing local communities to come together and wrap around as a support system to families that just need a little bit more help. A little bit more help, and maybe that child doesn't need to leave that home. I really believe in that concept. Shortly after getting here, when I received my first phone call from a family that was in the process of adopting a child, and they were doing an out-of-state adoption, and so for our department, that's low on the priority list, is when they come to the tyranny of the urgent throughout the day, out-of-state adoption home studies, that's pretty low on their list. And so this family had gotten to the final thing. They just needed the last touch done on their home study when they received a phone call from one of the local branches that I've connected with that, guess what, we can't complete that. You're back to square one. You have to find a different way to do this because we have other things that are taking our focus. And the woman actually asked what, and they said differential response. And that's actually what prompted many of the things that were just listed, the quotes from emails in my office, and prompted my office to really dig into this and get involved. And if you research the history over the last number of years, as this has kind of evolved to the point of which it is, you'll even see notes from LFO that warned about, as we add these hundreds of new positions for DR, that warned that the resources, that it would be inclined to pull them away from their other duties. And that's the point where we're at. And unfortunately, we're at that point, and they're so stretched thin that even in doing it, it's not working the way it's supposed to. And so why would we pour additional resources into a good idea that's not working? And I believe that it can work, but we do have to get back to the first things first. And I believe that we have good people at the agency that are ready and willing, that need direction from us. Do we want them doing 1,000 things at one time, or do we want them to really narrow their focus to make sure that the most important things, children's safety, children being kept alive, that these are the things at the very top of their list? And we're at a point where they need us to direct them and let them know this is number one. And not just as an individual, because we have some really good individuals in place right now that are making really good changes, but as an agency, because as you know, there is turnover. Okay, people transfer, people get different jobs, people get promotions, people get poached out to another spot, all sorts of things that happen. We need to put in a system that no matter who is at the top of the chain or the bottom of the chain, that the system works. And I think that, you know, a bill along these lines that says putting first things first is going to help us get there. That's about it, because hers was long enough.
Any questions? Senator Sanderson.
I don't want to have DHS be set up to fail. And we usually don't get involved in the weeds like you love, because you're a geek. you love to get into the workings. And I want to simplify this to see if you can identify with what I'm trying to say. There have been different math models in schools, and after 3 years, they found out it didn't work. I, as a legislature, wouldn't want to say, okay, school, you can't do that method, because there are a whole lot of other things involved in it that I, as a legislator, don't want to tell them what kind of program or math model that they want to use. And that's what I'm afraid we're doing here. I would rather have a report from DHS taking, what did you call it, the quality screening comprehensive, your report, and give a report back to us on why that report is as it is, rather than we making the decision of why, the reason why they should change something. Because I don't think we're qualified. Maybe you are, Sarah, but I am not qualified to do that. So I have questions. What you gave is right on. I've been in some reviews of child assessments, and everyone seems so individual, and I have no idea what the individual, reasons were for the cases that, the 100 cases that they had. But I would hate to draw conclusions from that report without really having DHS look at it, because there's a lot of smart people involved in DHS in working with this, and this is not an easy subject. So I just needed to let you know my concerns, because I am I don't feel we are qualified to start telling agencies what programs they should or should not use.
So, Chair Olson, Senator Amanda Sanderson, in regards to the math, with math and curriculum, there are different ways that kids learn, and things are different. In this case, kids are dying. And where the conclusion has come from that we have inadequate screening and inadequate assessment is from DHS. They're as of now, the only certs that are published online are the certs that are entirely comprised of DHS staff. Over and over and over again, the recommendations that come out about the systemic issue are a failure to have comprehensive assessment and a failure to have a centralized child abuse screening system. That is where that came from. DHS itself decided to do this report to go back and look at whether or not kids were safe. And I think as a legislature, as an oversight agency, when the department is failing to act with urgency, I'm disappointed that this report came out and there was not immediately a request to the legislature to say, oh my gosh, we need more resources, we need more help. We have left 47 kids in these conditions. I have not heard that urgency from anyone. I have not had anybody, when sending this report, say, this is what we are doing to keep these kids safe. This is what we are doing. This is how we are gathering people across the state to be able to make sure that people are appropriately trained to do this work, that we can have the workload that is there. And what I don't want to do is to end up in the same circumstance where we were with Give Us This Day, where the legislature failed in its oversight responsibilities to say first things first. With differential response, the legislature started that. We directed the agency to try it. We gave the money. And all this says is that you will add the disposition. They can continue providing services, doing all of the other things. It's there will be uniformity across the state, because half the state right now, all of their assessments end with a disposition. So it's not a new thing and it's not permanent. It just says you have to be able to meet these basic requirements of your own policy to be able to get there. When Director Psyche came to the Human Services Subcommittee of Ways and Means a couple of weeks ago and put up the performance metrics, the other entities within the department had mostly greens and yellows around whether or not they were meeting their key metrics. Child welfare was all red. The agency is in a state of chaos and disrepair, and if we do not want it to fall to a place that it cannot be fixed, the legislature has to intervene, has to put light on this, and has to hold the agency accountable for urgency around kids. Otherwise, we are going to continue having these certs where we see that kids have died that did not need to die, because if we had done appropriate assessment and screening, we would have been able to intervene and they would still be with us. So that's...
May I respond as well? Chair Wilson. Thank you. Chair Wilson, Senator Mona Sanderson. One of the things we hear agencies say on a regular basis is it's the legislature's job to put forth the policy, and then they are supposed to implement it. And so they can't always weigh in on these things, and especially when it comes to, like, differential response. This is something that we've put a tremendous amount of pressure on them to do. We've directed them to do it. Now, they have the ability to put it on hold and freeze it at times, but that would be expected that it would be temporary, because we provided millions of dollars and many positions in order to carry it out. So if we don't do something to change that directive, then they will feel pressure because we told them to do it. And so at some point, they're going to have to say, well, which do you want us to do? And so I do believe that there's a point that we may not all be, you know, well-versed in the world of, you know, child welfare, but there is a point where we say, well, you know what, guys, please focus on this. We'll get to that another time.
And just a little follow-up. I still don't feel comfortable making a decision about whether differential response is good or not. I don't think we are in that position. I still don't want to have DHS be set up to fail again when they are very aware of the report. They are trying to address the issues, and we can just agree to disagree on what role and how much we are going to get into the weeds in trying to solve this problem.
And Mr. Chair, if I may, I think going back to what the bill actually does, it does not say differential response bad, differential response good.
That.
It just says that there will be a disposition, and dispositions today are done in half the state for all of them, and in all traditional track assessments, even in the differential response. So it's, I believe that we have set up the agency to fail in the way that it is right now. If they are already doing the comprehensive assessment, this simply asks that the disposition be put in at the end of the comprehensive assessment. Hopefully they're doing the comprehensive assessment. I think this report suggests that they don't. And I don't necessarily believe that the department is moving forward on this report. It was not raised to the child safety team. There's this entire child safety team. It was not brought to that team. When I shared information about this with the director last week, he had not had the opportunity to read it. I would imagine if I got a report back like this, I would immediately brief the director.
But then that would be, that would be the reason why we need DHS to respond to it rather than us telling.
If DHS responded, the problem is DHS fails to act with urgency around child safety.
I think that we could direct them to respond. I truly do.
Chair Olson and members of the committee, one more thing on that. You know, when the governor's external audit, when we got, you know, we sat on that work group, and as it released its report, one of the most discouraging things, and Director Psyche has come and testified to this, was that very little was new. There's been numerous reports over the years about these things happening and all these things that needed to be fixed, and yet things weren't changing in a rapid or significant enough way that the next report or the next audit, the same things are coming forward and forward. And so I feel like at some point we have to change what we're doing in order if we expect them to change what they're doing.
And Mr. Chair, Senator Mona Sanderson, I think that in a case like this, in a report like this, we should not have to ask the agency to have a prompt response. A prompt response should be implied. That should be everything else stops and that gets addressed that day. And in the independent review that the governor brought in public knowledge to do, it also said we need comprehensive assessments. We need to improve the assessment process. This isn't something that I just came up with and put in a bill. It's in every single third party report, recommendation, study. We study. The department hires consultants. The consultants say to do the same things over and over and over again, and it does not happen. And it needs to happen because the statistics are getting worse rather than better. And the consequence is that we have kids that are no longer with us and kids that are with us that are suffering right as we sit in this room.
Senator Dimmer.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. And Chair in absentia, Gelser, we'll be hearing from the department, right?
Yes. Great. Hopefully they brought someone from Child Protective Services with them as well, and okay. Not just differential response.
Great. So I'm still trying to get a clear sense of what the bill does. And so, I mean, I can ask them of this, but I'm sure you know. So what is the difference between, you know, when a, I'm sorry, what's it called, when you have the... you know, the full evaluation by the multi-team.
The survey report?
No, not the survey.
The assessment, the right. Traditional response?
Yes. So as I understand it, what's happening is there's an initial assessment that's done, and it's the same everywhere in the state, to decide if the child is safe at home or not. And if they're not, then it automatically goes to the conditional process, and if they are deemed safe, then it may go through a differential response process.
No. The call comes into the hotline. The screener makes the decision about whether or not it will be an alternative response or traditional response before anybody ever goes out and sees the child. An alternative response can change to a traditional response at any time. But according to DHS policy, whether it is an alternative response case or a traditional response case, there's supposed to be a complete and thorough assessment, which should involve a visit to the Child Abuse Assessment Center. And we heard from Clackamas County that that's not happening, consultation with the collateral resources, which we heard from defense attorneys and district attorneys across the state, that's not happening in our prior hearing.
Okay.
The only difference that this would make is at the end of a traditional response case, you take all of the information, and the last thing that you enter into the database is whether the allegation of abuse was founded, unfounded, or unable to determine. In the alternative response case, you do everything except for enter that last piece of information in. All this does is says after you've completed the assessment that you are already completing, you enter in, was it founded, not founded, or unable to determine. It's not extra work because they're already doing all the work that leads up to that. It's entering the data into the system.
Okay. So the problem then is not with the initial screening. It's with the secondary screening, right, the follow-up. I mean, there's an initial screening that says this needs to be addressed within 24 hours, and that is being met somewhat but largely not. And then there's a requirement that there be that follow-up screening within 5 days, and those targets are not being met, are rarely being met, more rarely being met. So the problem then is, as you're suggesting, having the resources to do that secondary home visit by the department. Is that right?
No. The problem is at 3 points where the resources and the focus of training should be focused. The first is the call comes into the hotline. Right now, we don't have a centralized hotline. We have lots of individual hotlines around the state. There is no standardized training for a screener that sits in a hotline. Some screeners haven't had any training at all or have just been trained by the people that are in their district. So if you call into Eastern Oregon or Portland or Benton County, in some places there may be a facilitated decision-making process. In other cases, they may just open up a blank computer screen and there's nothing there. So that that is a problem that's been identified. We don't have uniformity of screening. Mm-hmm. Then those screeners in the DR counties have to decide, is this a case where the child is likely not safe and it's going to be a traditional response track, or is this going to be an alternative response track? Once that happens, it gets referred to the worker. And the problem when you are in districts where you don't have enough workers, so in Linn County right now where I live, there are 7 vacancies for CPS workers. They are down 7 people. So if I am a CPS worker that has a caseload bigger than what I can handle, and I have a pile of traditional response cases that have to be seen within 24 hours and alternative response cases that have to be seen within 5 days, I already believe that my alternative response are less important. They're less dangerous because they've been put into this other column. So they're likely to keep falling to the bottom of that pile, and they're not supposed to wait, but they end up waiting, not because the worker doesn't want to see them, but how are they supposed to do it when there are not enough of them to do the work?
Mm-hmm. Okay. And so,
so that gets to the timeliness of getting out to that initial face to face, and then the next one is actually completing the assessment, going out, right, talking to all the collateral resources, doing the appropriate interviews with the kids, yeah, not interviewing kids in front of their parents or domestic violence victims in front of their abusers to be able to determine whether or not a child is safe.
Right. So differential response has only been with us for a few years, right? A couple of years, started in 2014, I think.
Or,
these problems pre-existed it, right?
Yes. Chair Olson, Senator Dimbro. Mm-hmm. Yes, and that's the point. That's why at the beginning I said this isn't about differential response. This is about our screening and assessment, and we need to shore up screening and assessment if differential response is to be successful, because differential response at its core is based on good screening and assessment, mm-hmm, decisions that are able to ensure that kids are, yeah, safe, and so we don't have the resources to do that.
Do we have a sense, and maybe this is a question for DHS, of how much of our resources that could be going to better screening and better initial assessments are instead going to differential response?
Chair,
is that's the crux of the issue? I mean, from my perspective, I think the agency needs more resources. Period.
Yes.
And that should be our fundamental mission, to try to find, however we can, get them the money that they need. But, you know, absent that, presumably a certain amount of their budget is being diverted over to alternative strategies that you would argue should be staying with the traditional response. Do we know how much that is?
So, Vice Chair Olson, Senator Dimbro, we don't, but I would point to the CSFR, the University of Illinois report, Jason Walling, who was the deputy director, all talk about resources, that DR diverts resources from core responsibilities like foster family support, foster care certification, and adoption certification. We also know that caseworkers have said that DR takes more time. That said, 942 doesn't address any of that. All 942 does is says you have to put the disposition in at the end.
Okay. So, you know, when I read the report, the University of Illinois report, it did say that staff had very positive opinions of DR, mm-hmm, that over 80% felt it promotes child safety and well-being, positively affects families, and values families' cultural and ethnic backgrounds, and over 90% agreed that it involves families in decision-making. So that seems to be a pretty positive support to feeling from those who are doing the work. So, how does that align? I know we've been hearing some complaints, but.
So, Vice Chair Olson and Senator Dimbro, I think there are a couple things that you need to look at in that. Again, nobody is arguing that differential response, when adequately resourced and adequately trained and adequately implemented, is not a great thing. It is a beautiful idea. I would love for us to be able to do it statewide in an appropriate and safe way. The second thing is that those same workers also said that they felt very positively about the Oregon safety model. And finally, if you look at the footnotes in the report, less than a third of workers actually responded to the survey. So So you're looking at a very small number of the workers that are actually doing the work. And if you go out into the community and talk to the collateral partners about how it's impacting child safety, the traditional partners like the district attorneys, the designated medical professionals, the CASAs, the parent attorneys, and the child attorneys, they are saying that this is denying parents access to due process, denying kids access to safety. CRBs are saying kids are coming in with greater trauma because they're being left longer in DR counties, and that kids are falling off the radar without sunlight on the issues that they're having. So I think that there is some limitation to data that has a minority of the workers responding, and is a survey that really doesn't tie to qualitative and quantitative measures and talks to the outside, more neutral respondents about the impact on child safety.
Okay, I'll save my other questions for the agency.
Thank you. I have one. In your amendment, which is basically a gut and stuff of the bill, is that correct? In Section 2, it talks about the investigations, and they're not complete until the following criteria have been met. So how do you anticipate to complete the report in Section 2, Sub 1, until you have 95% or greater or centralized statewide childhood abuse? I don't see how that one connects to the other.
So Vice Chair Olson and members of the committee, those metrics are metrics that are, all of those metrics are recorded and reported to us every year. So it's not new data to collect. And it doesn't say you can't complete the assessment. It just says that we're going to continue entering a disposition at the end of every evaluation until we have hit those metrics. Some of those are for us. I mean, the agency can't staff at 95% of the caseload model until we allocate the resources for them to do it at 95% of the caseload model. But it is only logical that if we want people to be able to do this work the right way, to get the assessments done on time, to make the face-to-face contact on time, and not do that by eliminating support to foster families, stopping adoptions, and doing the other work, it requires the adequate number of bodies to get the work done.
Okay. From a perspective of coming into this a lot later than what you guys have been doing this at. I kind of relate this to, we want a cake, and this is an analogy. We the legislative body want a cake, and we tell DHS how to bake it, what to put into it, and everything else, and the cake doesn't come out the way we want it. It seems to me that we're sticking our fingers in rather than letting the agency do what we kind of give them a broad outline to do and let them make it work. And obviously it's not working, but is it our responsibility then to go in and pour more money into a program that we don't know will work?
Vice Chair Olson, Senator Dimbrough, I think there's a couple things about the cake. One, if you give the recipe to the cake, as Representative Stark said, legislature sets the policy, the agency implements, right? That's the whole three-branch thing. We set the recipe. Part of the recipe is the policies and the statutes. DHS is regularly failing to comply with existing Oregon administrative rules and statute as it relates to screening and assessment. So what we are saying is you have to follow the basic recipe. What this bill basically says is you can't take these cases into the darkness where nobody but DHS has oversight on them until you start complying with existing law and regulations around, it's a very reasonable thing to ask that assessments be completed in a timely way, that we send people out to put eyes on kids when we've identified that they are unsafe in a timely way, and timely is defined by what is required by statute and rule. It is not too much to ask the agency to comply with statute and rule, and shame on us if we know that the agency is not only not complying with statute and rule, but as a result, children are dying and are being abused and are suffering, and we do not exercise our oversight, authority, and responsibility and obligation to say you must comply with the law and the rules that exist. I believe that's a basic responsibility that the legislature has, to hold the agency accountable for doing the very base responsibilities, and the agency should be panicked if all of their, or if most of their criteria are in red. 15% of the time, timely completion of assessment. That's not close. That's not edging up. That is a crisis. That is especially a crisis for the workers that have to live for it and for the kids that are waiting for somebody to help them.
Well, this will be the last question. I agree with you wholeheartedly, save for the fact that even though we write the rules and regulations, we tell them what we expect them to do, and they don't do it. Why do you presume that this small adjustment will in fact stimulate them to do it? Because when we say you can only drive 65 on the freeway and people drive 80, they still do it and they still get away with it. So what's your assumption that this bill will be the panacea? This bill will actually drive them into doing what they're supposed to do at the time they're supposed to do it?
Vice Chair Olson, members of the committee, a couple answers to that. One, it's not the panacea. There are a lot of issues in child welfare. This, again, is just saying first things first, we do the basics before we add on the bells and whistles. Secondly, it is very clear that there are a lot of people at DHS whose primary goal is to implement differential response, regardless of whatever else may happen. This creates an incentive to be able to fully implement differential response by meeting these basic standards, because it does not eliminate differential response. It just says before, you know, it's like I tell my kids, before you can go to the movies, you have to finish your homework and put the dishes away. You have to get your responsibilities done first before you can do the extra things, before you can be in the play, before you can get an after school job. The second is that the issues here are so significant in terms of child safety. I mean, the numbers do not lie in terms of where we compare to the rest of the country, to where we compare to where we've been in the past, and to what is happening to kids. This puts more transparency on it. What we lose in the alternative response, and what we lose in alternative response with not having a disposition, is that we no longer have adequate comparison data to see what is the reabuse rate in DR counties versus non-DR counties. Because to be reabuse, there has to be an initial abuse disposition. That disposition is never made in an alternative response case. So we could say, we're not going to found anything anymore. Nothing is going to be founded. And if we no longer put dispositions on anything, does that mean that we don't have child abuse in Oregon anymore? No, it just means we didn't put the disposition down. By putting the disposition down, we can keep track of the rates of abuse county by county. We can keep track of the rate of reabuse and not be artificially driving that down for our CSFR and other reports. And we pull things back in more tightly into the timeline for completion, because we can see when something has been founded, unfounded, or unable to determine on time. It's much easier to see that. And this is exactly the same thing that we do in senior services. It's what we do in developmental disability services. It's what we do in the child care and agency services. In every other program, an assessment has to end with a disposition. Did it happen or not?
I find your example interesting. With your children, you can't go to the movie unless you get your homework done, you get the dishes put away. In this case, we're saying we want you to do this and we're going to put more money to it to make it work. That's kind of a
no. What this is saying, what this is saying is that, you know, to Senator Montes Anderson's point, the agency right now is totally set up to fail. They are completely set up to fail. If you look at those workers that go out there in the field, there are not enough of them in the offices. We don't give them the training they need. We don't give them enough supervisors with experience to give them the support that they need. They're young, and we send them out to do these incredibly heartbreaking and impossible jobs. That, and we don't give them the resources to buy. It's not that DHS is sitting there saying, I don't want to train people, I don't want to hire people. We haven't given them the resources to do it. So the piece about the staffing at 95% is we have an obligation here. We share in the responsibility for the kids that we've lost, because we have not adequately funded the infrastructure of a workable child welfare system, and we must do that.
I do. So do we have data to support that in those cases where dispositions happen, there's a greater success rate or rather a lesser, instance of harm being done to the children? I'm just wondering, because we do, we can look at where we are today versus before differential response. We can look at differential response counties versus non-differential response counties. So, in some, dispositions are happening in every case, or, back before differential response, dispositions were happening in every case. Were things better then? And you know, is that the goal for the DR counties to get to where the non-DR counties are, or for everyone to get back to where they were before differential response? You know, I guess that's the question, you know, just if we're looking at it in a data-driven manner.
So, Vice Chair Olson, Senator Dimbrough, it's a little bit different than that. I mean, the way the differential response is described on the DHS website is as an enhancement to the Oregon Safety Model, which is kind of that assessment process. What the premise of this bill is that the foundation of a quality child welfare system is quality screening and assessment. It doesn't matter if it's a differential response case or a traditional response case. You need a comprehensive and quality assessment. If we're going to compare apples to apples, you have to be able to look at that disposition at the end to be able to compare it. And because we are having such a problem with the timelines, this helps us better manage where we are getting to with the timelines. The entire premise of this is for differential response to work, you have to have quality screening and you have to have an assessment center that works. We don't have that yet. We need to focus on that first so that we can do differential response, which has a lot of promise for children and for families and for the state. But we set ourselves up to fail when we jump ahead to do that and we don't resource it either with the money or the training or the people or the basic foundation and understanding of how to do an assessment.
Chair Gelser, we've had a request to bring DHS up. So I think we need to do
so the
that.
Plan was, I've already talked with DHS. DHS yeah. is going to come last after we've got SEIU coming and some other folks.
Okay.
That are,
well,
that are
anybody
first.
That wants to step into the guillotine now can.
So are we done with questions for us?
Well, we hope so. If we want to get done today.
Yep.
Do you want me to call them up, Sarah?
Yeah, so we want...
Stacy Cowan,
and Jean Vinson. Yeah.
That's
and
all.
Then the, and Allison Kelly.
And Allison Kelly.
Yeah.
Jean Vinson, Stacy Cowan, and Allison Kelly. There's your tools back.
Thank you, Chair Gelser, Vice Chair Olson, members of the committee. Stacy Cowan with SEIU Local 503. SEIU represents the frontline workers at DHS Child Welfare, and we wanted to be here in support of Senate Bill 942 and the -1 amendment. I think that it's very clear that the child welfare system is in crisis. It seems like I'm stating the obvious, but still important to remember here. The amendment has a lot of really important metrics. I would argue the most important of which is the 95% staffing at caseload model. We simply can't meet the other metrics without that, and it really is a domino effect of everything that's happening within the agency when we don't see adequate staffing. What I hear from workers when I'm talking to workers is that they absolutely want to be a part of the solution. I hear from folks that they absolutely need and are desperate for a fully staffed team. Folks want mentoring. They want support. They do some very, very hard work, and at the end of the day, they turn to their colleagues to be able to talk about that hard work. Sometimes that's the kind of work you don't necessarily take home and want to share with your family members. They need someone that they can turn to for mentoring and support. And they absolutely want training for themselves as well as their coworkers. A couple of pieces about that is we have to ensure when we're pulling caseworkers off of their caseload, number one, we can't do that until we have an adequately staffed agency. But we have to ensure that it's high-quality training. So many times I hear from folks that they were pulled off of their caseworker and they're sitting in a training wondering what in the world it has to do with their work. We have to absolutely make sure that that training relates back to their work. So many times, and I think this was mentioned in the slide, is that folks receive good quality training, but they're not quite sure how it relates to their work or how to absolutely integrate it into their work. Earlier this month, we drafted a report and shared it with legislators calling for several different policy changes and budget changes at the agency, and it included increased staffing as well as increasing provider payments. We believe that these are two really important pieces of the puzzle when talking about moving child welfare forward. We just want to thank the senator for her work. We recognize this is really challenging work. Again, the folks that are on the front lines really want to be a part of the solution to help move the agency forward, and we appreciate the very challenging conversation. So thank you.
Thank you.
All right.
Chairman Gelser and Vice Chair Olson, members of the committee, I'm Jean Vinson. And I come from Lane County, Eugene, Springfield. I work at the Relief Nursery as a prevention community director. Keeping Families Together is an initiative in Springfield for the prevention of abuse and neglect. Started 3 years ago, just before differential response. So we were brought in. I work with the entire city of Springfield, the mayor, the school board, business community, everyone, to mobilize them on behalf of children. And we welcomed, because I work with a coalition of about 50 different community providers that I just described. So since Lane County was the first to implement differential response, we had a chance to not only receive the training, but also to see how it unfolded. So I listened to the testimony from February and really studied that, listened to the questions from Clackamas, from Benton County, and I thought, okay, what would be meaningful as you make these all-important decisions, because we're all working from what Senator Winters emphasized, improve child welfare. That's our responsibility, every one of us. So something that I haven't heard that I'd like to add is we haven't talked about the Navigator program, which is an integral part of differential response. Who are the Navigators? Highly trained, experienced home visitors assigned by the caseworkers with rigorous oversight to meet with the differential response families to advocate for them and also work with the caseworkers to conduct the safety needs assessment screening. If there's additional screening for those families, it's the Navigator, such as if it's an addiction or a child who has a behavioral problem, all of those risk factors that these families, because as we know, what we're talking about is the complexity of this issue. And so the Navigators, there are five at the Relief Nursery. They have a much smaller caseload. That's what we're talking about, overwhelming work. They work closely with the caseworkers, and with 15 families per Navigator, they meet with each family at least once a week.
So can I ask,
yes,
just because this bill isn't really about the Navigators,
no,
it's about the dispositions.
Right.
Does a disposition make it impossible for you to provide Relief Nursery services or a Navigator?
No.
Or can you provide those to people that have a disposition entered at the end of the assessment?
We work with child welfare. We always have. You know very well what the model of the Relief Nursery is. And really the Navigator program, the reason I talk about it is not being discussed here. As you look at, and I know.
Well, and I think that's because this bill is simply about adding dispositions and the assessments. It's,
right.
It's different than the differential response.
And yet I think I'm trying to build on the differential response side, because here's what I want to add to that, and I understand, Senator Gelser, and I appreciate your efforts in this, is we're talking about added time from child welfare. Actually, I see that we are engaging the families, and as the report said from the University of Illinois, and I was in all of the four assessments in Lane County, with that, I just wanted to add that program in. I just thought it was really important to know that are engaging families. I have three stories from Navigators, if I can submit that, if you want to look at that, because I know you're trying to put a face on this, but I just wanted to put in, this is a program that's working. It really is, and it's around the Relief Nursery model. We put in a respite program 4 days a week there, and so I know our time is short. I know your bill is all well intentioned, but there are parts of the differential response that are working.
Right. Thank you very much. Ms. Kelly.
Senator Gelser, Vice Chair Senator Olson, thank you, members of the committee, for the opportunity to be here today. My name is Allison Kelly, and I'm the CEO of Liberty House, which is the Child Abuse Assessment Center here in Salem. We serve both Marion and Polk counties. And I'll try to keep my points brief. As I listened to Senator Gelser speak to you earlier, it is dawning on me that this entire conversation is really happening at that intersection of statewide public policy and practice and also local policy and practice. So the one thing that I would also call to your attention is the Multidisciplinary Team Response Statute, ORS 418747, where the DA in every county is responsible for convening that MDT and lists the professionals that need to be on the MDT. And there's a reason for that. These assessments, as you well know, so I think what I'm going to do now is just kind of hone in on the point, that comprehensive assessment. And also, just to let you know, I am the chair of the Oregon Network of Child Abuse Assessment Centers. I also happen to be a lawyer. I have almost 20 years in public policy work as a mediator, a facilitator, working with really big, complex public policy issues, and this is one of them. And complex public policy issues require complex solutions. So, for one, that comprehensive assessment is crucial. And we work with the DHS caseworkers very closely when they're doing those assessments. I submitted two documents to the committee for you, and I also handed the committee assistant paper copies. And if I may just speak to those quickly, it gives you an opportunity to look at what is it that they need and that they're looking at in that moment of after they've gotten that referral from the screening, from the hotline. They need to look at what they have on their hands. Some of these cases do involve children that will fit under Carley's Law. So that's the first chart that you see, and I'll just run through this quickly. This is a training diagram, and I've had an opportunity. I want to thank Director Psyche, who's here today. I've had an opportunity to meet with him as well and his staff. This is a diagram that we put together just to try to help our local folks understand what does this law require. And when you have an investigation and they're looking at that suspicious physical injury, including but not limited to what's on that list, and then they're trying to determine whether there's certainty or reasonable suspicion, whether there's an injury, they're looking at a lot of things. And what I've learned, especially over the last year, is that they need some medical information during the part where they're trying to figure out what they have on there, what are they seeing. And so they'll call the local centers. There are 21 child abuse assessment centers in the state serving 36 counties, and we're trying to be as much of a resource as we can. Our medical director, who came on 4 years ago, said that 4 years ago they would get maybe five of these calls a week, and the calls sound like this. I'm out in the field. I'm investigating these allegations. I've got a kiddo with the bruise or whatever the nature of the injury. Can you tell me about it? If I send you this picture, can you tell me? And we've had several this morning. Can you tell me if the parent's description of how the injury occurred, whether that makes sense with this injury? And we can't, actually.
Doesn't Carley's Law require all of those go to a medical assessment?
They do. And the reason, but they don't know whether they even have Carley's Law yet. That's the point. So they'll call and try to get a little information. And then they're trying to understand, well, is it reasonable suspicion? And therefore, then, if you see on the right-hand side of that chart under phase two, then the requirements of the law kick in, being able to see that designated medical provider, take pictures, and be seen. So the one point that I want to make is that the scale, the number of calls we're getting now, five maybe a week, 5 years ago, we're getting 5 to 10 a day at Liberty House. We serve Marion and Polk counties. There's so much maltreatment or alleged maltreatment out there, it really does require those resources to properly respond. And then the next document I want to share with you, we're trying to help triage and trying to be solution-oriented and bring resources to the table so we can get to the I need to get our medical providers off the phone so we can open up appointments so that we can comply with that law and open up appointments so that caseworker can bring kiddos in to be seen. So what you see there is it's a form and two pages, basic information about the case on the first page. But the second page, this colored, is really the result of what's the latest in the medical literature, part of the DHS administrative rules, what they're looking at, as well as our experience. Information about the child, information about parent, caregiver, information about the child's environment. And what this really amounts to is a risk assessment. The more positive checks we have on this, we're going to know that we really need to triage that and try to prioritize seeing that child. But the issue is that, in fact, all of the cases that Senator Gelzer highlighted in her PowerPoint, that's the norm for us. We get 10 of those a day. It's not just an isolated thing. The risks out in the communities for our children in the state of Oregon are beyond belief.
Now, so I'm going to have to ask you to sum up so we can give DHS a chance to get up here as well.
Absolutely. So what I would say, and what I've said to Director Psyche and I said to the Senator, I would request that it's not an either or. I think it's a both and. I think we need to throw resources and training and the partnership as well with our DHS partners, as well as with your center, child abuse centers. There are other bills related to that. If there's anything that I can do to be helpful providing information about what this looks like on the ground, I'm happy to help in any way I can. Thank you.
Allison, in a budget environment like this one, let's say you have $10 to allocate to addressing the problems. How would you divide that up if your choice was screening, assessment, partnerships? And given where we are right now, knowing that we don't have the money to do all the things that we want, what do you see as the place to spend the money that would have the greatest impact on child safety?
I wasn't prepared for that question. I'm a mediator used to bringing a lot of people together to hammer out a solution. So I would bring a lot of people together to hammer out a solution, including some of the partners we see here, including our director. Child abuse centers haven't been at the table before on this, so we want to be at the table because your caseworkers can't move forward unless they have qualified medical documentation. That's why the statutes require that DMP. And we're running charity events right now to try to fund our really expensive medical staff. So I think it's all of the above, but it is an emergency. Everything that you said, Senator, is not hyperbole. It is an emergency. We are facing the most severe conditions for children in this state. So thank you for the opportunity to be here today.
Right. Thank you very much. And DHS.
You have 2 minutes.
Well, we can stay. We can stay for time. Can people stay till 5 till, please? Or somebody? Okay.
So, Chair Gessler, Vice Chair Olson, members of the committee, for the record, Clyde Psyche, Director for the Department of Human Services, and like Representative Stark, I would agree, probably one of the most depressing and demoralizing discussions I've been involved in since I've taken the role of DHS Director. So I just want to address a couple of points, and this was brought up by the presentation. So the first point is, you know, if anyone in this building feels that there's not a sense of urgency on the part of the department or on my part to deal with this issue, then that's on me, and that's a failure of leadership, because I have spent, I think, a lot of time with a lot of people talking about the issues we have and how critical they are. And so if I have not been able to deliver that message, then that's on me, and I'm going to have to think about the work I've done over the last 14 months and how effective I've been, or ineffective I've been, I guess, at this point in time. Resources are an issue. There's no doubt about it. Daily, our caseworkers have to make decisions about what body of work is going to get done and what body of work is not going to get done. And that's a really tough position to put people in. But there's some other things I think that were talked about earlier that I just need to put on the record and address. So I totally agree with what the senator and the representative said earlier about that a lot of these issues are issues that have come up in the past and have not been dealt with, and the department has to own that. But my strategy has been, we are going to have to deal with these issues in a different way. If we think we can keep doing what we've been doing over the last 5 years and improve things and make a difference, we're sadly mistaken. We have to take a different approach. We have to look at things differently, because if we just keep doing what we're doing and keep doing what we've been doing in the past, we're going to get the same result, and that's unacceptable. So one of the things is, anytime we get into this situation, we commission a bunch of reports and we put together a bunch of committees. They come up with 20 or 30 recommendations, and we try to do everything at once. And when you're our agency that's already under-resourced, if you try to do 20 or 30 things, especially when some of those things are significant at once, then you're not going to be successful. So I think to one of the points that Senator Gelser raised, we have to prioritize. We have to determine what the most important issues are that we need to address. And then we need to prioritize those and really work hard to solidify them and lock them down. And I think without doing that, we're not going to be successful. So I think there's a lot of, we've had a lot of discussion about differential response, non-differential response. I will tell you, in my personal opinion, one of the issues that DHS has had is that we think we're the experts. We operate in a silo, and we don't engage other people in helping us solve the problem and do the work. And I'm convinced that if we continue to do that, we're not going to be successful. We have to reach out to communities. We have to engage other governmental entities. We have to engage organizations like Allison's organization. We're going to have to engage nonprofits, stakeholders. And it's really, to me, not about differential response or not differential response. I am firmly believe that if we try to do this alone, and don't reach out and form those partnerships and form different models of providing services, not just to keep children safe, but to prevent, to intervene at a very early stage so it doesn't get to a place where we have to take kids into foster care, then that's something we have to very seriously consider. So I just wanted to really kind of put on the record or talk to you about you know, I just can't tell you how hard our people work. And if anyone thinks that we don't have a sense of urgency and we're just sitting around waiting for something to happen or don't feel like we're in a crisis or don't feel that there aren't changes that have to be made and things that have to be done, then I'd invite you to come over and spend time in our office any day of the week, because every single person I work with has that sense of urgency, knows we have a crisis on our hands, and works hard every single day. 7 days a week, sometimes 10, 12 hours a day. But it's not just about working harder. It's about working smarter. And we have to work smarter. And we have to be sure that the approach we're taking is going to give us the outcomes we want. And I would submit to you that doing things the way we've done it in the past is not going to get us that outcome.
So, Clyde, what is the plan in the next 4 weeks in response to the GJ report? Like, what are the measurable steps that the agency is taking with a sense of urgency to address the problems with assessment?
Chair Gelser, so the first thing we've done is we've pulled together all the things around the CERT and identified trends and issues that have happened over the past 5, 6 years, however long we've gone back. We're doing analysis on those trends. We've already talked to our field staff, because the other piece of it is I don't think we can solve this problem just sitting in the human services building in Salem trying to problem solve. We have to engage the people who are actually doing the work, the frontline people, and they have to help us kind of identify what the issues are and also identify solutions to the issues. So we're really identifying people. Well, first of all, we're identifying trends. So one of the things we've identified is we struggle when a case has to be handed off between districts or even branch offices, the lack of communication, the lack of protocols. I've already had a discussion with the district managers, and we're putting together a plan to how to memorialize or really solidify what protocols are as we hand off a case between district and district. What information needs to be shared, who needs to be informed, and what kind of interchange has to happen between caseworkers as we head off.
But Clyde, the question was more the report that came out of your child safety program where you had 47 kids identified as safe that were clearly very unsafe. What is happening right now today to address that problem to make sure that there aren't people out assessing kids today and saying they're safe and leaving them in those kinds of conditions? What's happened since you got that
Chair
report?
So, Chair Gelser, we got the report like Friday of last week.
Because that's, I sent it to you, but the department has had it for a couple of months.
Right. I did not get a copy until Friday of this week, so I haven't even had a chance to sit down with staff and say, so tell me what this report says. The one thing I
want to
Am I
the only person that gave you the report?
What's that?
Did you receive the report from me?
Yes.
Am I the only person that gave you
the
report? Does that concern you? That
yes,
it
concerns me a great deal. And I also found out that the report was sent out. It concerns me that I didn't have a chance to look at the report before it was sent out. I mean, both those things concern me, but those are internal issues that I have to deal with. But the one thing, Senator, what I will tell you is that I need a chance to go back and look at it. I need a chance to ask questions. I need a chance to kind of take a look at what the issues are, because The one thing I've also seen happen is that we react to something, and I don't want to say we won't react to it quickly, because we should, but if we react to it before we figure out what we're looking at and what the issue is, then we try to solve the wrong problem. And what happens then is we spend a lot of time and don't really solve the problem at hand or make any progress. And so I just need some time to sit down and say, what does this really tell me? What's the trends? Who are these kids? Where are they located? What piece of this might be associated with a traditional response model? What piece of this might be associated with an alternative response? So that's, I guess that would be my answer to your question. I need some time to really sit down and take a look at it.
I'm sure, actually, it's more a question for you. Will we have an opportunity to bring Director Psyche and the others back for some more questioning before we take action on this? Because I'd really appreciate it. I'd appreciate giving him the time to digest this report and then, you know, for us to, you know, really understand the best way, whether it's dispositions or whatever, to, you know, bring this, you know, these horrendous, the numbers of horrendous cases like this down.
Yes, and I think that's absolutely the case. I hope that when you come back, you'd be willing to bring somebody from your child safety program to be part of that. And that I think the concern that I have about the report is, and I mean, I was in the room when you told them to send me the report, and I hope that nobody in the agency is being discouraged from sharing information because it's unpopular within the agency, and that child safety information is never prevented from coming forward. I know that you personally would never do that, but if there are concerns about that in the agency, I hope you would make it clear that that we're in a new place and people can speak about problems in the agency, especially if they're being told not to.
So, Chair Kelser, Vice Chair Olson, members of the committee. So, I've had that discussion with staff, and staff have told me that has not happened. I believe staff, and my motto is always to believe somebody until they give me a reason not to believe them. But if something like that happens, then I'll hold people accountable to it.
Thank you. Any other questions? No. Thank you all very much. I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 942, and we are adjourned. Hearing on Senate Bill 942, and we are adjourned.